Good morning, everyone. We will convene this committee meeting. It is February 17th. This is the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. And we don't have a quorum at this time, but we will before we get finished. We're about to learn about performance measures from Judy Moore Peterson. And we say good morning to Barney Spade as well, and we can get started.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson.
Just a moment.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, good morning. Thank you. For the record, Barney Spade, Administrator, Office of Medical Assistance Programs. I did want, before Judy gets into performance measures, and she will be talking about issues behind the tab, performance measures and outcomes, I did want to let you know that we delivered to Mr. Britton this morning a packet answering many of the questions that were asked yesterday. There are a couple that we're still researching, but I just wanted to bring that to your attention.
Thank you.
And I would like to introduce Judy Moore Peterson, who is the manager of our analysis and evaluation section for the Office of Management or Office of Medical Assistance Programs. Judy?
Thank you. Judy.
You want me to repeat? Do I get to repeat that all again here? So, for the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the manager for the Analysis and Evaluation Unit in the Office of Medical Assistance Programs for the Department of Human Services. I'm going to be covering the performance measures and outcomes for the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. And so I'd like to call your attention to two different documents that I'll be working from. One is after the tab that says, after the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, it says performance measures and outcomes, and also the document that was handed out yesterday that says Ways and Means Presentation. It has national regional comparisons, February of 2005. While you're looking for that, I'll just start by introducing the various performance measures. We have seven of them. Four of them are related to access to care.
John?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So four of our performance measures are related to access to care, and three are related to the receipt of some form of preventive care. The first two that I'd like to talk about are our key performance measures that are the department-level measures, and that's key performance measure number 25 and number 26. And those are the receipt of some kind of a doctor visit by either adult or child, which is key measure performance measure number 25, and that's also broken out by race and ethnicity, which is the key performance measure number 26. These two performance measures, we've actually have not performed up to what we had wanted. We've seen actually a rather steady decline since 2000. We saw a kind of a steep decline from 2000 to 2001, and then remained steady through 2001 and 2002, and then I saw a drop amongst adults in 2003. The reason for the drop in 2003 for the adults is most likely due to the impact of the loss of some of the benefits for OHP standard population, the implementation of co-pays at the same time period. So that's what we think is going on with those particular measure with adults and children.
Okay, I'm looking for the same page you have.
Mm-hmm. We're on here and now on.
We need to point to performance versus this other one.
Okay. Right. There's actually a graph on page two after that.
All right, got it.
Okay.
Hey, that's good.
Certainly, John Britton.
Judy and Barney, on the graph at the top of page two, it does show a decrease with the adults in performance measurement receiving primary care.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember correctly, and please correct my remembering, if you would, that was a time when certain benefits from OHP standard were removed, and a number of managed care plans decided not to cover OHP standard because some of those benefits had been removed. Is that right?
That is.
So in other words, the my question is, from 02 to 03, is that a result of loss of managed care in that particular system, I guess is where I'm going.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Britton, that is part of it, and momentarily I will show you our regional or our national comparison, which highlights that difference between the receipt of care between fee-for-service and managed care. Yeah. The other reason that we believe impacts that is also the implementation of co-pays, and that did reduce. This is the receipt of a doctor visit, and we did implement co-pays at that same time period in February of 2003 for the OHP standard population. And so at that time period, there was a reduction in the number of overall visits that OHP standard adults would have gone to. So actually, then let's turn to the first graph that's in the handout with the national regional comparisons. At the top, it says adult access to preventive and ambulatory health services. Okay. Mm-hmm. We don't have an exact regional comparison or national comparison. So this is the closest proxy that we could find. It is what's known as a HEDIS measure, and that's the Health Plan Employer Data and Information Set that's oftentimes referred to as its acronym of HEDIS. It's put out by the National Committee for Quality Assurance. That's a national body that accredits managed health care plans, both Medicaid and commercial. And the top, you'll see that there's an adult access to preventive and ambulatory health services, and it's broken out by various years. The first column under fee-for-service is the Oregon Health Plan, and this is for measurement year 2002, so this is prior to 2003. It's the most recent data that we had available. The next one is how our managed care plans performed in providing an ambulatory care visit, which is a doctor visit during that year. And the last column is the national average for Medicaid managed care plans. If you note, for the adults, our fully capitated health plans actually rank in the 75th, well, you may not know that, but they rank above the national average Medicaid managed care plans, and they, for the ages 20 through 64, they're in the 75th to 90th percentile. So they do very, very well. And also with the age of 65 plus, they are also above the national average. Whereas our fee-for-service population, you can see that they don't get in as often. And we think that has to do with access to care issues. That's one of our strategies for improving access to care, is enrolling clients into managed care. The same thing with the...
Go ahead. Well, do you want to stop there for a moment? I just want to make certain that do you have the table, Senator Winters?
Okay. No.
Okay.
Some of us do not have what was handed out yesterday.
Okay.
Okay.
Do we have any extra copies? Okay. Again, I want to, for interpreting this chart on the fly, the first two columns are Oregon performance data. The first column, fee-for-service, is non-managed care. The middle column is our fully capitated. And then the benchmark that we're really comparing to is the last column, which is the average of national Medicaid managed care. And the summary for the top box, as Judy indicated, is that our managed care plans are outperforming the national average of Medicaid managed care plans relative to access to primary care for adults.
Are we all on the same page now? On the handout? I apologize. Yesterday we brought all the copies and they were all handed out, and I realized that the next day that paperwork gets misplaced and
yes.
not in binders.
Yeah. Because it would be very helpful that most of the, and I appreciate you gave it to us yesterday, but most of us are also in other committees, and so it's kind of, if we can go in logical sequence, it helps a lot. Because yours is not the only committee that we're wrestling with on funding, and so
right.
it's probably better if you just give it to us the day that you're going to give the presentation.
Right, and I made the assumption that I was going to be going yesterday, so I didn't think of collecting them back up again. The child measure is looking at the child access to the primary care provider. It's slightly different than the other one. It's not the receipt of a. I'm sorry.
I'm not catching up to you yet. So can we
okay.
go back a little bit?
Sure.
I'm looking at the first chart. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I'm looking at ages 20 to 44, mm-hmm. fee-for-services and fully capitated health plans. And to make sure I understand it, 57.4% of those in the plan between the ages of 20 and 44 utilized benefits within a year period, which means 43% did not have any contacts with doctors. Is that correct?
They, Mr. Chair, the 57.4% did not go to a doctor. They may have had other contact with the health system. They may have gone to the hospital or the emergency room, et cetera, but they did not go to...
You mean did not or you mean did?
They did go.
They did go. 57.4% did go to a doctor.
Okay. And then the fully capitated plans, 83% did go.
That would be correct.
And yet, what I'm hearing from you is that the fully capitated plans, not just you, but the presentation, are much more efficient and effective and cost-effective than are the fee-for-service plans. And so I'm trying to figure out the conflict, because while we want people to utilize doctors when, you know, when they need it, how is it cheaper to have 83% of the population utilizing, meaning going and a fully capitated plan where money's being paid, and only 57% of fee-for-service being going, which means that you only pay for what you get, so 43% aren't getting paid anything or are costing the system anything since they're not going to a fee-for-service. How is that more expensive than the fully capitated plan?
Let me start, Mr. Chair, if I may, and then Judy can add to this and correct me if I'm wrong. First of all, in the presentation yesterday, one of the core principles of our health management plan is early intervention, early access to preventive and primary care. And so we emphasize the access to primary care. In addition, for the fully capitated health plans, for our managed care system, we prepay. They're prepaid in advance.
On 100% of the population that are in the fully
capitated. That's correct. And they bear the financial risk. And in the medical management scheme, it is actually better to invest and spend money at this point in time in primary care to optimize the access to primary and preventive medicine, helps offset downstream other downstream costs. So a key management benchmark in managed care, whether it be publicly sponsored managed care or privately sponsored, is are we getting the value for the prepayment that we send to the plans to buy the access to care for primary prevention? This is one proxy of indicating that we are getting the value, particularly compared to a national benchmark. And the first column points out the difficulty in the fee-for-service system, which is a combination of both, it is unmanaged generally, and the nature of the reimbursement system in fee-for-service makes it much more difficult for our clients to access primary care in that venue. Does that help describe that?
Well, it kind of does, but I guess what you're saying, especially in the second column, which is 45 to 64, where you have 80% of the population that are going to fee-for-service receiving care, and 88% under the fully capitated rate, I guess what you're saying is that people go in a fully capitated plan more frequently and before things get as far along as fee-for-service, and so even though they're full accessing care and fee-for-service, they may be going after things are worse, and so it costs more. And so if you take a look at it overall, the costs, even though there's less utilization, they're greater for the fee-for-service than a fully capitated plan.
That's a fair summary. The other is in the managed care plans, what we emphasize and what the plans emphasize is that every client have a medical home, that they have a primary care, they get linked to a primary care provider. That primary care provider in many cases wants to encourage visits, preventive visits, in the case of children for immunization, well baby checkups, etc. And so we're actually creating a system of what one could say, because it's prepaid, of easier access to primary and preventive services, and that is the investment longer term to prevent overutilization of the emergency department, unnecessary hospitalizations or complications because of health situations that don't get taken care of in a timely basis.
Okay, throughout the 90s when we had HMOs and that type of managed care, the complaint against it was that it encouraged overutilization and that drove up the costs. But what I'm really hearing from you is that isn't the case. Even though their people may go more frequently, they're going before things get more serious, and therefore there's an overall cost savings. Is that fair?
Mr. Chair, actually, the backlash against managed care from a cost point of view and from an access point of view in the classic commercial market that you described was not overutilization. It was the perception that the underutilization that was brought about by a disciplined system was, in fact, keeping people from care. Now, a lot of people will describe that the $5 office visit for an HMO in a relatively unmanaged system, an unmanaged HMO system, encouraged access, but the discipline with primary care, what's called primary care gatekeeper, a derogative term, other kinds of pre-authorization, is that many people who were forced into commercial HMOs did not feel that they were getting easy access to care. They actually thought that they were being shunted aside and could not get particularly specialty care. And the actual performance of HMOs in the period of their heyday in the mid-90s was when we saw the lowest increases in medical inflation in my lifetime.
Okay, and I know that we're on performance measures, but I just wanted, one thing kind of led to another there, and this is a huge issue for policy purposes. So thank you for making that clarification.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Winters.
The measurements are for O2. Do you have any measurements for O3 or O4? And if not, do you plan to have them? Because it would be nice to look at to see what changes, if any, have occurred in these various categories.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, the national comparison is the most recent that is available. However, on the actual performance measure, which is in your Ways and Means document, after the tab that says OMAP and then it says Performance Measures and Outcomes on page 2, the most recent data that we have available is in 03. And indeed, we did see a drop-off that we do believe is due to the changes with the benefit package for OHP standard and the co-pays, as well as managed care dropping a lot, of not taking OHP standard.
Another question. Could you provide us with the Medicaid, the number that we're serving currently for Medicaid and what it's cost us and how we compare to our neighbor to the north, and I hate to compare our neighbor to the south, but anyway, and to Idaho and Utah, both in terms of numbers, what their numbers are, and in terms of their costs.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, actually,
If you look at the last page, Mr. Chair, with your permission, we'll get a little out of order to be able to answer this. And anticipating your question, the last page of the handout looks like this. It's labeled Western States Ranking Medicaid Expenditures per Medicaid Recipient.
For fiscal year 2001.
For fiscal year 2001, this is the most recent data that is available through CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and this does show you the Now, I want to put some disclaimers on this. This is total Medicaid spending, so that it includes not only health benefits, but also long-term care benefits.
Yeah.
And it's impossible, by the way, that CMS collects the data on a national for us to tease it apart. We knew that you would probably like to see it health to health, but state and national comparisons are not available. This does show 2001. We do have some data from earlier years, but you can see that that on a U.S. average in 2000 for federal fiscal year 2001, the U.S. average was about $4,000 per recipient.
Well, I think to complete this, it would help me if I had the number of recipients. You know, we've got the ranking and we've got the dollar amount. The population pool would be helpful because we know how many it is in Oregon.
We can get that. And this is on a per-recipient basis.
But it doesn't tell you how many.
Per capita. In other words, if we have a huge number of recipients, we could be spending a tremendous percentage of overall resources, but still be a low. And also, it depends.
Well, actually, I mean, one of the interesting comparisons, and we'll get the denominator so you can compare the denominators, but, and correct me if I'm wrong on this one, Idaho has, I think, a much smaller Medicaid population. So the number of people that they're covering is smaller than ours, but you'll see their average per recipient expenditure is about $1,000 a recipient higher than ours.
Would it be affected by the fact that Oregon has a much larger percentage of elderly that are on the system receiving a low monthly amount? I mean, would that just kind of skew the averages?
Mr. Chair, I think it has to do with, I think that the long-term care costs do influence that relatively low per Medicaid recipient cost. And I think when you have the presentation next week from Seniors and People with Disabilities, they'll be addressing their aspects of keeping controlling costs, but I do believe that Oregon is one of the states with one of the more effective community and home-based waiver programs, which does reduce overall our long-term care costs per Medicaid recipient.
Just kind of in line with Senator Winner's question, do we have a breakdown that shows the categories of Medicaid so that we can see how we stand on health care as compared to the whole package?
Mr. Chair, unfortunately, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services do not break out the data that we were able to find anywhere that broken down like that.
What we can do, Mr. Chair, though, is for example, taking Idaho, we can get the enrollment in each of the actual numbers of enrollment for this period of time on average enrollment by categories, so you can see the relativity of how big programs are by eligibility category. And then I would just summarize the point that Judy made, is that because the waiver that we received, I believe, in 1981 for home and community-based care and long-term care, that will, when these are added together, that will have a dramatic impact on long-term care spending. The reverse of that is the states that do not have that and are, if you will, using more institutional-based long-term care than we are, their costs will be higher.
Okay. This is useful for us to have this additional information. We know it's all extra work, but it would be valuable because we have, you know, Medicaid categoricals, mm-hmm. and those we can compare with fairly, you know, usefully with other states in getting an idea as to the efficiency that our Oregon Health Plan Plus has as compared to other states, where if it's all grouped together, it looks good, but we don't really know if there's other factors that are influencing the numbers and that really we're really high. You know, I'd love to see that we're not and that we're right in as far as the
well, on an aggregate basis in 2001, we're performing well. That's how I would interpret this chart relative to other states and the national average for total Medicaid spending.
You know, because we have a more unique elderly care and numbers in it, it might change it. So if we could just get some figures on the categorical expenditures for our state versus some of the local states or surrounding states, that would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, we'll do what we can in finding the information.
That's all we can ask for. Thank you. Representative Hannah.
Thank you. Looking again at the top graph there, the 20 to 44-year-olds, I still have a question whether measuring the number of people or number of times that group goes to the doctor. And what if we took that group, the 20 to 44-year-olds in the capitated plan versus a group of 20 to 44-year-olds in a regular indemnity-style health insurance plan and measured the wellness of the two groups? Does the number of times you go to the physician, is that a good measure of your health? I mean,
that's a good,
that's
point.
Where I'm trying to get. It's like if you took another group that went to the doctor, only 50% of them went to the doctor, but does it mean they're less healthy?
Let me start, and then Judy.
We're talking about outputs versus outcomes,
right?
And measuring outputs.
What I'd like to start in response to is to call back a study that I commissioned when I was with the Office of Health Policy and Research. It's probably the best thing I did in state government in 3 years. But we looked at what we asked an actuary to do is to look at a population within the Medicaid program that was closest to a commercially insured population. And the TANF population is essentially the population that's closest to a commercial. It's not the age, blind, and disabled. It's families, et cetera. And I will get this for you because I think it's the most insightful. It doesn't answer your question with kind of finality, but it's suggestive. And we asked them to look at the cost of commercial versus the cost of Medicaid and to make the adjustments of in Medicaid, there's no cost sharing because generally people are poor. And there's not the level of cost sharing there is in commercial markets. So you get a number of puts and takes for things like cost sharing, higher reimbursement in the commercial market, lower reimbursement in publicly sponsored programs. But the most telling one was health status. And their review actuarially was that I recall this generally and I'll get to specifics, was that the health status of TANF population was about upward put of about 20% compared to a commercial population. That led me to believe, as a layman, and Judy is much more expert, is that we do have a population that is sicker, at least in the sense that they have probably pent up unmet health needs because oftentimes they're not continuously enrolled in an organized health plan. I'll get that information. It's from about a 1998 study, but it did compare a plan. The plan was essentially the same. So that's my first response to your question. Judy, do you have?
Just a little clarification. Mr. Chair and Representative Hanna, this is actually looking at, it's comparing Medicaid populations across the board. So that the final column that says the national average for Medicaid managed care is comparing, if you will, more or less of a like population. Also, the fact that oftentimes health status is related to age. And so this is across the same age groupings. And then also, this is not measuring how many health visits a person got, but it's measuring whether they got at least one. So this is the percent of people who had at least one doctor's visit during the year. So I don't know if that directly answers it, but it is looking at that. And in general, nationally, the National Committee for Quality Assurance actually considers, which does also accredit commercial plans as well as Medicaid and Medicare plans, that the higher the number here, they consider to be an aspect of improved performance. They look at that as a good thing and not as overutilization. And that if you do get into that mix of whether you do have overutilization, people are going to the doctor all the time, et cetera, but this is admittedly, rather a kind of a crude measure of access to care. Nationally, that's how they do it, and that's how they measure it, and that's why it's being provided here.
Just my follow-up, and I appreciate your attempts to answer. I think it's a tough issue to get a handle on to some degree,
But I, this year withstanding, because it hasn't been my best start, but I would look at years that I didn't go to the doctor as a very successful and helpful year in many cases. And I think many people would think, you know, if you could stay away from Dr. Bates' office, we'd probably all be a little better off, you know.
Lots of reasons.
but the point is, it's whether or not somebody went to the doctor or not, measuring where they are in health just doesn't quite add up to me. It's not quite dead on, but that's the discussion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, we can appreciate that. That is a complex issue. There's less controversy, at least over the child access to care issues, as far as the primary care provider, and that's the graph, that's the table that's right below the one in your handout. For example, for the ages 12 to 24 months, the standards of care are that every child goes at least once to the doctor in those age groups of 12 to 24 months. And so the fully capitated health plans, again, are outperforming it within fee-for-service, and you're getting close to 100% of the kids being recorded as having a visit with a primary care physician. Or a primary care visit. If there aren't any other questions on this particular one, I'd like to move on to our next performance measure.
Will you be referring to the chart that's Western States ranking percentage of children on Medicaid at a different performance measure? Or
yes,
okay.
I will be. the next performance measure is actually as key performance measure number 26. It's on page 3. Page 3 of your document in your actual book, and it's looking at access to care and health disparities based on racial and ethnic populations. And it shouldn't be a large surprise, but there are health disparities nationwide, and they also exist here in Oregon. This is taking a look at the same measure that was the one that we were just looking at as far as a visit to the doctor, and it's breaking it out by racial and ethnic groups. Again, like the previous measure, we did see a drop-off between 2000 and 2001. And the most striking thing is the level of disparities amongst African Americans and Asians with the other populations. And that is, this is the first year we've had this measure breaking out the different racial and ethnic groups. And so we have been targeting those particular populations with the largest disparities in our efforts, and we've been working with several community-based groups, the African American Health Coalition in particular. We worked with a project with several managed care plans in the Portland metropolitan area that targeted sending out preventive mailings to the African American community to improve care for diabetes and smoking, et cetera. And we did see some positive results from that. For example, with the African American population that was targeted, we actually saw an increase of 20% in coming in for the appropriate tests for diabetes care. There are no, for this particular measure, there were no national regional comparisons other than a pretty broad survey that was an access to care survey, a community access survey that asked whether they saw doctors, and we saw the same kind of disparities exist nationally. It wasn't broken out by Medicaid or even low income. If you'd like to turn to the next outcome measure, and this is to increase the proportion of births covered by the Oregon Health Plan as compared to uninsured births. It's on page 4 of your Ways and Means document. And here, what we would like to see is we would like to see an inverse relationship between uninsured births, or what's also referred to as self-pay births, and those births that are covered by Medicaid or the Oregon Health Plan. And that is indeed what we've seen in the past couple of years. We had a low point in 1998, and at that time period we had a very strong economy, and we had fewer people who were coming onto the Oregon Health Plan. But I also will note that it was also a relatively high point of self-pay births. And so since that time, we've seen a steady increase in the number of births covered by Medicaid, and a decrease in the number of self-pay births. That has some very positive impacts on the population in general, or on the Medicaid population. For example, we did a study that took a look at immunization rates, which we'll talk about in a little bit, but we found that one of the main reasons for children not to be adequately immunized on the Medicaid program was that they didn't start off on the Oregon Health Plan when they were born. And so we find that it is very important for them to have some source of insurance as an assurance of access to care when they're first born. In your handout, you should have a table that says Western states ranking percent of Medicaid births. And you want to look
what
at
handout?
That? There was a handout
from yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's our national performance measures, national regional comparisons, February 2005. And Oregon ranks 29th with the most recent data that we had available, and that was for the reporting year of 2002. The one exception for that is Wyoming, which included those who were born also during 2003, and they counted some who were in 2002, which probably accounts for nearly 50% of their births being on for Medicaid. So this is the regional comparison. This is influenced by two factors. One, the level of poverty within the state, and then two, the how high the federal poverty level is for that Medicaid covers within that state. I do have some information on that in a little bit. That if you were interested in, we could talk about that. That's covering the percent of Medicaid children in the next measure. So I will move on to the next measure.
Senator Wesson, Chair, before we do. On the percentage of Oregon births, mm-hmm. OHP and uninsured, are those percentages on page 4, are those percentages, I mean, 37% in 03, 37.8 in 02, are those percent of total births?
Yes.
In the state.
In the
That's
state.
That's correct.
If you, what's missing here to add to 100, if you take 03, if you took 37.6 and added the 3.5 and subtracted it from the 100, the others were basically sponsored by commercial insurance.
And so my point here is that we have round numbers 14-15% of the OHP insured population in this state. But one-third, a much higher percentage, mm-hmm. are being covered by Oregon Health Plan, and births are one of the, cost of deliveries, one of the fastest-growing cost drivers in health care.
Sure.
So we have one-third of the births in the state comprise 14% of the population, 14-15% of the population. This is a big cost driver right here. Anyway, just an observation, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, one thing I might add is that this, I think what the state would like to see is fewer overall births being percentage-wise being covered by the Oregon Health Plan and fewer being uninsured.
Right.
Ideally, that's what you would like to see.
Well, and one of the ways you cut the cost of those deliveries is good prenatal care, and that's so it's good to have them covered someplace, and
right. Much
better OHP than no coverage.
Another view of saying what Judy said is if a pregnant woman is not covered by commercial insurance for her pregnancy, we want her to be covered by Medicaid, because if it's an uninsured pregnancy, we raise the likelihood of an untoward birth outcome, and downstream costs that are significant.
I just said that, Barney.
Yes, Senator, you did.
No follow-up. Please continue.
Thank you. Moving on to the next measure, which is it's actually in your book. It's on page 5 after the in the tab that says performance measures and outcomes, and it's a simple count of how many children have been covered by the Oregon Health Plan. There's a bar graph there, and you'll see that there has been a relatively steady increase. We saw a steady increase between 1998 and 2000, and then again in 2001. The increase in 1999 and 2000 is likely due to the implementation of the CHIP program, or the Child Health Insurance Program, in July of 1998. And then the more recent increases are likely due to the worsening economy. In the handout that was handed out yesterday...
And now on the screen.
Oh, thank you. there's a chart that is equivalent or similar to the chart that Barney showed yesterday, that shows for the overall coverage of the Oregon Health Plan, but this is focused just on children, and it shows the uninsurance rate and then also the percentage of children that are being covered by Medicaid or the Oregon Health Plan. You see some similar patterns in that you see a fairly high uninsurance rate in 1990, and then dropping to, we believe that's influenced by the Oregon Health Plan, to 1996. Also, there's a drop-off in 1998, which I think is also reflective of a relatively good economy. And then you start to see increases again as well. I do want to call attention to that this is in every other year, because that's how the uninsurance information is taken from the Oregon Population Survey, which is done every other year. So we came up with a comparable percent of the Oregon Health Plan children.
Oh, Percy Penna.
Just for reference, as you look at 03, what's the total number of zero birth to 18-year-old children in Oregon?
Just figured.
And what percentage is 290,000 of that total? Because I think Senator Westland said we have 15% of the people on the plan, but what percent of the children is it?
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, let me, with all due respect, correct Senator Westland. I do this very rarely. Yesterday, we showed a percent of the total population, of the total enrollment of the Oregon Health Plan to the total population. It was an overhead graph. I'm trying to find it. I had it here, but it's about 12%, 12 in a decimal point. So the proportion of the total Oregon Health Plan to the total population is in the 12.4 range. This graph that's in front of you right now, that's up on the slide, that's on the screen, for 2004 indicates that about 24% of the children in Oregon were enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, one can conclude that the role that the Oregon Health Plan plays relative to children is significantly higher than, if you will, the average enrollment for the whole plan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanna, I have my notes on the exact number sitting over there in my bag. They didn't make it into here, and we'd be happy to get that for you.
Oh, it's okay. By using both graphs, we got there.
Okay.
It's 12.3 total as of last year.
Mr. Chair, you actually asked if we was going to get to the Western States ranking of the percent of Medicaid children in the handout, and now is the time that we're going to turn to that particular table. This is a regional comparison, and what you see is that Oregon, you know, as it covers about almost a quarter of the population, and you can see a range for these Western states from the a relatively low, the bottom of the pack here in Nevada, at a ranking of 51, and up to our neighbors to the north, Washington, which is ranked at number 12 in the country. The U.S. average is just above what ours is. Like the Medicaid burst, this is influenced by the level of poverty, how many children live in poverty within those states, as well as by the how high of the percent of the federal poverty level these states cover for children. For example, our state covers up to 185% of the federal poverty level through both our Medicaid and CHIP programs. And then Washington State, for example, goes up to, in this particular year, went up to 200% in the Medicaid program and up to 250% in their CHIP program.
Mr. Chair. Senator Bates.
This is a policy decision. We went through an e-board and went through prior to that, and some of us pushed very hard that since this is a higher match, I think it's
70-30.
70-20. Close. And fairly inexpensive program in comparison to the rest of the health program that we should push in that direction. Also, I'd say there's some situations, I believe, where these children don't have much choice in where they're at. Others may feel differently about that. It was a big battle, and one, frankly, that I flat out lost. I pushed this. I thought we should have been the same level Washington is. I think it would have cost very little to do that. And I'm just putting my two bits in right now publicly that I think that was a policy choice that was incorrect. We have a governor that's pushing to help kids, and we couldn't get support on this. So I'm just laying it out there.
The citizens didn't agree with you either.
Yeah, the legislature didn't agree with me. Okay.
Mr. Chair, we'll move on to the next outcome measure, and that's related to prenatal care in the first trimester. And what I'd like to have you do is actually turn to the prenatal care in the first trimester graph that's in your handout. The reason being is it's the same graph that's in your book, except that it has the actual percentages listed there for you. And then Tuesday night, we were actually able to fill in the last blank there in the U.S. average for 2003. There's a preliminary figure for the U.S. average, and that's 84.1%. We didn't find it or get it located in time to be able to make it into this graph. In general, there's two things that we can that can draw your attention. Is if you look at the black columns, which is the Oregon Medicaid, you can see that while we've made very very small but steady increases over time, this is particularly since 1998, at which time we improved our working together with public health, particularly with the Office of Family Health, and I think that those numbers of improving of prenatal care in the first trimester are a result of some of those efforts. The other thing that you can also note...
Yes, Senator Moss Anderson.
When a pregnant woman presents herself to who has no insurance, and they sometimes wait until after the second semester, is that why we're not higher up? I mean, I guess I want to know how many women didn't have insurance and then were eligible for Medicaid.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, I don't...
Senator.
I'm sorry. Senator Mona Sanderson, I apologize. I don't know... And I'm not sure we would be able to find out how many women have were uninsured when they came onto the Oregon Health Plan. However, we do know from a different performance measure, that's one of the key performance measures, that by the fourth month, that low-income women are getting prenatal care. 90% of them are getting prenatal care. So given that math, we are assuming that part of the difficulty of reaching this or seeing why we're so rural has to do with getting identifying the pregnant women who are uninsured and getting them onto the Oregon Health Plan as quickly as possible. And that actually are some of our strategies that we've been using, is try to identify and then expediting their applications. As soon as they are identified, we process them within 24 hours of receiving them within the Oregon Health Plan Central Processing Branch.
Just follow up. I know it was very frustrating in the clinics when we would pregnancy test, when they would come in to see if they were pregnant. Then would really try to encourage them to get signed up for the Oregon Health Plan or to schedule for a prenatal visit, and so many wouldn't. So that's the reason for the question. It isn't that the clinics or nurses weren't trying to do it, but sometimes the choices of the patient don't allow us to get them in early.
Just on that vein, that this is all pregnancies. Now, if this was only dealing with first pregnancies, it might be of more value. But on subsequent pregnancies, which our own family had several, the woman knows when she's pregnant, she's been through it before, and that she doesn't need to rush to a doctor in the first trimester. They go on. I mean, so it's not always an indication that there is a major problem if they don't go to the doctor in the first 3 months of being pregnant.
We don't like to hear that.
You may not like to, but I'm going to speak for
myself.
Folks that are not necessarily so immersed in the system that they only it's a lot of this is like a psychiatrist who thinks everybody's neurotic because that's where he spends all his time, and yet we have a cross section of the entire state that we're dealing with, and so if we're only dealing with people on Medicare or first pregnancies or low income or those kinds of situations, then you're going to have a different focus than if you're dealing with the population at large.
All due respect, there are situations where, and I'm one, it's my last child, that our bodies are not the same. There are complications. There are times when you need at the first blush that you see that you're pregnant, and I'm one that immediately goes to the doctor because it requires some care so that I can make certain that I have a very healthy birth. And so it isn't just whether or not you're in a socioeconomic level and you've had a child before. Not all childbirths are alike, and so as a woman, I have to tell you that that's not an accurate statement.
And although I'm not a woman, I can certainly also say, though, that having a baby is not a disease. It is a natural process. But nevertheless, why don't we go ahead and proceed? I assume that I'm outnumbered in this position.
Chair, I can't leave that completely unchallenged.
Senator Baker.
Take my hat off as a senator here. I mean, your family may be large enough to be statistically significant, okay? We can actually run a study with 8 children or 9 children. But setting aside, first pregnancies are the ones we are most concerned about. I agree. They are probably the most risky ones, assuming that the subsequent ones have been preceded by a normal pregnancy. Having said that, pregnancy is a natural process that carries a high morbidity and mortality if you don't have proper prenatal care. We have good studies to show that early intervention in pregnancy from the point of view of nutrition and helping that woman through the pregnancy makes a huge difference on the other end as far as premature birth concern, low weight birth concern, and even in subsequent deliveries where there's been a good history prior to that, early prenatal care is vital. And so I'd have to respectfully disagree with you as a physician, and I'll just leave it there for you, okay?
We can proceed.
I'd like to move on to the next performance measure. That's on the increase the percentage of Oregon Health Plan clients age 3 and younger who have received adequate immunizations. It's on page 7 of your Ways and Means document, and then also on the next, you'll see it on the next page in your handout, the regional comparison.
There you go.
Is that? Yeah.
slides.
It's also in the PowerPoint slide.
It's on the screen right now.
The Oregon Health Plan children are the black bar on the far right-hand side, and you will know.
Or the light green bar on the screen.
Okay, thanks.
Light blue. I'm colorblind.
And what you will note there is that we had a long ways to improve, and that we have done a lot of work and we've made a lot of progress in improving. This particular measure was initially developed, and it still maintains that way, as a part of the Government Performance Measurements Act, and it was actually focused on managed care. And so this is a measure of the adequacy of immunizations within our managed care organizations. And the other thing that we're very pleased to see that we've had steady improvements. We did see a blip in 2002 in which we've increased up to 83% being adequately immunized, and then you'll see a drop-off. We believe that drop-off has to do with there were some shortages in the state, and there were some recommendations that a fourth diphtheria tetanus pertussis shot be delayed. And so as a consequence, we believe that influenced this particular drop-off. However, we still have seen steady influence and been able to move forward on those particular ones. I'd like to just go ahead and move to the Western States ranking of immunization rates for children, actually in the Women, Infants, and Children's program. It's the only regional or national comparisons that we could find that was anything close to a proxy as opposed to the actual Medicaid children. It's in your handout as opposed into your book. You will note that the rate here is slightly higher than what it is for the Oregon Health Plan children in general. While there's a number of children who are on the Oregon Health Plan, who are in the Women, Infants, and Children's program who are on the Oregon Health Plan, well over half, only about a quarter of the overall of the Oregon Health Plan children are actually in the WIC program, so it's not a one-to-one correspondence. And the nice thing to see here is also that Oregon has been moving up to where they have been traditionally, so that we're now ranked 17th within this low-income population. I'd like to actually move to our last performance measure, which is looking at preventive health services. It's on page 9 in your Ways and Means document. And what this is looking at is the provision of preventive health services based on both the dental preventive care as well as within the Health Services Commission list. You'll also see an Appendix B in your appendices in your Ways and Means document under Appendix B on OHP program results. You'll also see some overall numbers on the numbers of mammograms, for example, that we provided within a one-year time period, the number of dental visits, et cetera, which are very quite high. One of the things that I'd like to call your attention to is that we've seen steady increases over time for children in the receipt of preventive services. However, like the very first measure that we looked at, we saw a drop-off in 2003 in the adult population. Again, our feeling is that this had to do with the changes in the OHP standard program, both in the benefits as well as the implementation of co-pays. And that concludes our section on the performance measures and outcomes.
Should come with standard.
Yes, that's
correct. All right. Any questions? Thank you. Move on to 10% reduction list.
Why is this? I'm going to do that. Prioritization. And then the time.
Okay, let's do that first. Yeah.
Okay.
We'll go to prioritization.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that this time we would like to move into priorities.
Please.
And I will move.
Well, you can stay there. It's okay.
Okay.
Sure.
And Mr. Nickel going to.
Yes. He's going to join us.
Thanks for numbering these pages. That really does help on the handouts when they're numbered.
I don't think we have any more.
No, I just put it back at that so it wouldn't be a distraction.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Barry Cass, Assistant Director for Health Services, and we now turn to that portion of the presentation where we will discuss the priorities that the department has brought forward for its programs in health services and also the list of reduction options that you had requested of us, taking the priorities first. Now, John Britton has distributed. We're not going to have to go back into the book over and over again. This is a very straightforward process, and we've provided material for you to use as we walk through these. Let me make a few introductory comments, and then we'll talk about the decisions that the department has brought forward with respect to priorities. First, let me say that of the 73 priority items that were listed, health services has 8 of the top 20. And I want to stress that what's high or low on the list does not reflect the value of any of these services or programs. We really don't have low priorities in health services. Many of the programs that we operated several years ago have been significantly reduced, hundreds of millions of dollars over the course of the past 3 years, and you have in your documentation a complete record of what those reductions have meant. Furthermore, as we talk about reductions in health services, it's impossible to do that without also referring to other programs and services within human services, because these programs are interrelated. And I can give you a good example of that is that our ability to place geropsychiatric patients, that is older patients with dementias or other functional psychiatric disorders in the community, is linked directly to the budget for senior people with disabilities, because those services are provided out of another cluster in the department. I want to also point out that as we went through this priority exercise, we did not rank services with respect to the source of funds. We were looking at the entire package of services. And I hope you keep that in mind, although I would point out that over the years, as we have been cutting general fund from the budget and shifting to a federal fund strategy, what you have left us with are general fund support are those services of the highest priority. So you'll notice that there are some fairly high general fund items at the top of the list, but if you look at the bottom of the list, there's some high general fund items there too. The criteria that we used in the department to evaluate each of these categories, and I want to point out again that the categories are based on the budget structure. And in health services, in some cases we're talking about a service program, and in others we're talking about a whole office with a package of services. Now, we'll get to that in just a moment. As we looked at each of these categories, we were looking at what was mandated, that is what we're obliged under law to provide, the scope of the program in terms of the reach numbers served in a given service area. We also wanted to appreciate the value that Oregonians place on services that they receive. An important consideration, and one that was foremost in the governor's mind, was return on investment. Are we getting value for the dollars that we're spending in a given service? And are those services producing demonstrable results? In addition, risk is an important consideration. That is to say, are there services where, in their absence, there would be an almost certain elevation of risk beyond a point that we would consider intolerable? For example, removing services from a person with severe disability, health services from a person with severe disabilities who depends on that service. And in some cases, in addition to what's indicated in the statement on the document, we were also considering the viability of a service. That is, in making adjustments in the budget, can we assure the continued ability to provide a service? For example, would the federal government be able to approve adjustments in the waiver for the Medicaid program, or would we have sufficient structure in a community to run a public health program or a mental health program? And finally, and this will arise with respect to state hospital beds, is there in our inventory alternatives that would allow us or give us a reasonable chance of succeeding without a given service? And we will talk in a few minutes about Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center. So if you turn to the list, and I've asked Barney and Bob to be here because you will have questions, I think, about specifics here that they can answer with more detail. And if you look at the list, the highest priority for the Department of Human Services is the Oregon Health Plan and what some people often call physical medicine. That is, these are the services that are provided in general medical care, both managed care, fee-for-service, client-related adjustments that may be made. That whole package of the Oregon Health Plan implemented under statute with a total price tag of about $2.7 billion. Highest priority because it reaches so many people, there are so many risks, and it is tied directly to so many outcomes in the Department of Human Services across the entire range of services, all populations in the state. The next priority in health services, third in the department, is our community mental health programs. These programs are vital to the survival of people with severe psychiatric disabilities, and they also are tied to the fate of our state hospital programs. And we made the point in our discussion, I believe, yesterday morning, but I think Bob Nickel also touched on this the day before, that there is a relationship between the availability of community services and the population in the state institution. And over the years, we have been shifting to the community, and so those community services are a critical factor in the balance that we've achieved between institutional and community care. The next priority is alcohol and drug treatment. And here we have a category of services that addresses probably the most significant cost driver in all of human services, the abuse of alcohol and other drugs. And when you look at child welfare, as you did last week, talk about methamphetamine, talk about the rate of alcohol and drug abuse among correctional institutions, it is clear that alcohol and drug abuse and dependency and addiction are key cost drivers in virtually every category. The next priority is our mental health components of the Oregon Health Plan. There are two aspects here. One is that these services, like community mental health services that are provided to non-eligible individuals, are a part of the entire infrastructure of community mental health services.
Okay, Representative Hannah.
Help me just a little bit. I might be jumping back up one to the drug and alcohol.
Number 14.
So number 13. It's number 13.
Okay.
In the health services.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
No. Yeah, number 13.
Mr. Chairman, I probably should have explained that by taking the health services priorities out of the entire list of 73, what we've displayed on the left column is the number from the entire department's list of priorities. So if we had another column, we could say that alcohol and drug treatment is third in the list of health services priorities.
Okay, then I don't know how to reference this. Page 3 of 6, item 35 is also drug and alcohol. How do those relate?
That's prevention.
That's good.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hannah, these are alcohol and drug prevention programs aimed at targeted risk groups to keep them from engaging in alcohol and drug use, abuse, and addiction. And
treatment versus
prevention.
Okay, thank you.
It's a somewhat cruel choice. I think another dimension of priority setting is looking at the short versus long term and where the costs are going to occur now versus later. I think it's arguable the relationship between prevention and treatment, and we ought to maybe be spending 10 times as much on prevention. But that's a choice that is very difficult to make. Shall I move on?
Please.
I was talking about the Oregon Health Plan mental health components and that they are directly related to the viability of our community mental health system, that we have a number of people in community settings who used to reside in state hospitals and are dependent on these the funding of these services. I would also point out that when these services were removed from the benefit for the standard population, there were demonstrable effects in emergency departments. They are directly linked, and we have, I think, pretty good research that quantifies that. So the savings from not operating this service are certainly an illusion. Number 15 for the department and the fifth in row in order for health services are a package of intensive services for children. As Bob Nickel mentioned and can pursue further if you like this morning, we are in the process of an initiative that brings all of these intensive services into common management to provide the optimal service for each child at the right stage of treatment. Most of these services are funded now by the Oregon Health Plan. Anything you would add to that? One of the changes that's about to occur is the closure of a warded Oregon State Hospital and the relocation of those services to community residential settings that are supported by this category by this priority. Oregon State Hospital is 16th in the department, and I want to note here that most of what we do at the Oregon State Hospital is mandated, and it is not unreasonable to ask, well, why isn't the mandated program at the top of the list and the programs in the community that are not mandated but are critical at a higher priority? And the reason for that, and I mentioned this yesterday, is that in the mental health world, if you only do what's mandated, people will deteriorate to the point of requiring hospitalization, and we will be spending a lot more money in the institution. Just to illustrate that, I think Bob mentioned that at the peak of our institution populations in the late 1950s, there were 5,000 state hospital patients. And if we had an equivalent number today, 10,000 state hospital patients, we'd be spending billions each biennium, pure general fund, supporting those individuals. So, in a sense, we've made a priority decision. We've weighed these factors and said we need to invest in the community. That's where the best hope is for controlling both these costs and the illness that people face. I do want to make this note for you that in the governor's recommended budget, we will be closing 90 beds in the geropsychiatric program. Our ability to do that will depend on the ability to provide services in community settings for those individuals, most of whom depend on services funded through seniors and people with disabilities. And now that the decision has been made to close the remaining adolescent ward, Oregon State Hospital, by the end of next biennium, will be 120 beds smaller than it is today. What will be left are forensic patients, essentially, and some civilly committed patients. Sir?
My recollection was that it was mentioned earlier this week that the average daily population in the state hospital is about 800, with 1,400 over the whole year, but was that about right?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Bob Nickel. I'm the administrator for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. The actual number is about 750 patients at any given time right now in the state hospitals. We serve more people than that in the course of a year or two because people come in and go out. So that's why the numbers are a little bit different.
So that actually comes out, I mean, if you just did the math, it's approaching $250,000 per patient.
Mr. Chair, the daily cost for state hospital patients is about $390 a day, and I'd have to do the math to get to a yearly figure.
Okay, well, if we're looking at $187.8 million for the state hospital system, and your average daily patients is 750, there's other services there beyond the seven. I know there's a lot of real estate and all these other things involved, but it's a pretty expensive program.
Mr. Chair, I would agree that it's a very expensive program, particularly in view of the fact that it takes almost entirely state general funds to do that, and there's very little opportunity to match with Medicaid.
Mr. Chair, I would add that the savings achieved by closing one bed are equivalent to 35% or 40% of the cost of care because of the fixed cost in operating a huge institution.
Change the overhead that much.
When you made the decision, in effect, to close the state hospital in Wilsonville, damaged state hospital, the savings that were achieved by closing the entire institution, not by closing one ward at a time. Over the past several years, we've been opening wards, closing wards, trying to adjust the size of that hospital to its context in the whole community. And that's why I think the emergency board in November funded a study of the state hospital, what services are needed, what the physical plant looks like, to get a whole comprehensive view. And I understand we should have something for the committee by May.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We will hopefully sign the contract with a national architectural engineer firm early next week. That's my hope, and that they can begin to work there then intensively. And we will have, by contract language, a report to the legislature available by May 15th.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Melissa Anderson.
When we take patients out of the state hospital and put them into the community, we get then a Medicaid match. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Melissa Anderson, the answer is correct, assuming that the person is Medicaid eligible. And virtually all of the civilly committed patients who leave the state hospital are, but our experience is that for one reason or another, only about half of the forensic patients are. So that's the only exception that I would make to the way
and
you...
And what think. Is the match?
The match, Mr. Chair, Senator Melissa Anderson, is approximately 40 cents for state funds, and the other 60 cents is federal money.
Thank you.
Yeah, just before we leave this, this is one of the most important aspects of this committee's review because the cost of this system is so huge on a per-patient basis compared to anything else that we're dealing with, and coming from general funds, you know, such a huge extent general funds, that I'm very anxious to see the report and would be happy to look at a draft that wasn't fully edited so I don't have to wait till May to see it, to see what kind of... And what the report says and what the recommendations are. And I'm very interested, and I think our whole committee is interested, in what the alternatives are, because every 2 years we continue to put out in excess of $200,000 per patient served for a program that was started 20 years ago. And there may be better ways to do that. I mean, if we could just knock off maybe $100,000 per patient, maybe it would be worthwhile. And so I'm ignorant because I'm new, but I'm very interested in focusing in on this issue, where we're at, what is being proposed, what can be done, what's being done in other states, and what should be Oregon's long-term policy and program and goal to lessen the consequence, the costs, and improve the quality of care that we're able to provide. Senator Bates and then Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, what might be interesting is something, a question I've never asked, and I should have. I know you've been working on this issue now, I'm aware, for the last 3 years, and are trying to move people out. The federal government wants you to move people out, and that's why they make a match for one and not for the other, as long as they're small. I think the number is 16 small group homes. And as long as you can do that safely, for the public and for the client both, obviously that's the direction you have to move. One of your problems is with ballot measure 11, you're getting a huge input in the forensic part of this all the time, which is ratcheted up faster than we thought in the last 2 years, is my understanding. When we talked about this 2 years ago, what we thought was coming in was this, and now it's this. So that's compounded the problem. Well, the question is, what other states are doing on the same issue? They have the same issue we do. What are their costs per patient? I think our costs are about $200,000 a year, which is an unbelievable number, which I first heard 2 years ago. And I agree with you entirely. I was just stunned by that. Went over and visited what you're dealing with and realized cost of drugs, the facility, the amount of security you have to have, and the incredible danger some of these people for themselves and others makes it very difficult. But having said all those things, what are other states doing? What does it look like per cost per patient in other areas? I mean, what's the situation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, we've begun to look at the neighboring similar size state hospital in Western Washington State Hospital. Their staffing costs we are finding are about, or at least the staffing level is about 30 to 40% higher than our state hospital staffing is. So I haven't seen, and I can go up and try to find their daily cost of rates, but my assumption is that it's higher than what ours are, just because staffing is the main driver of the costs in a hospital like this. And we're operating about 30 to 40% fewer staff for every level of position. So, but I can go back and find out the information in terms of comparable cost. I would like to point out that about 25% of our budget is spent on the state hospital. And the last figures that I looked at nationally showed us in the top 10 states in terms of the lowest percentage of funds spent in our state hospital relative to the community programs. So I think it's important for the committee to understand that Oregon has already moved quite a ways in the direction of lowering the reliance on state hospitals, but it's still, I think, a fact that it's costing a great deal per patient. And I think the final thing I would say is that every state that I know of is struggling with the increase in forensic populations.
Well, a couple of decades ago when we when was Fairview shut down, roughly?
Mr. Chairman, year 2000. January, February 2000.
Okay, well, when we started group homes was a couple of decades ago. When was that?
Mr. Chair, yes, we've had group homes in Oregon for probably 20 to 30 years. They've sometimes been called different things. But what we started in the early 90s was this entire additional level of care, which we call extended care. And that really dates back about 12 years. And for example, we've created locked, secure residential treatment facilities, which is a higher level of care but still much cheaper than the state hospital for patients who could be in the community and we can get Medicaid but really don't require hospital level of care anymore. And we have about 6 or 8 of those now scattered around the state.
A while back, I spent some time with the originator of a program in Southern Oregon. And he was telling me the numbers at the time that it was over $200,000 per patient if you just did the basic math, and that it was, you know, they were able to provide a better life in a community, in a group homes situation for about $32,000 a year, which, you know, certainly is, for a number of reasons, for all the reasons, it is a great move. But we're still... Yeah, we still have a ways to go, and so with that in mind, Senator Winters.
And I want to follow up on the question of what are other states doing, and I think we need to put somewhat in perspective. There's a difference in the Fairview population and what's occurring now at the state hospital, because you're talking forensic and mental health rather than developmentally disabled population, and Oregon, started with people first. I think it was back in 19. I'm going to date myself, 69 or 70, when we began to talk about that and moving the Fairview population and those individuals into the community structure. But I'd like to know really what other states are doing, and you come from the same state that I do, which tends to be one that claims to pioneer new innovation, and that's Kansas. And so I'd like for you to tell me what Kansas is doing, not only with respect to this particular issue, but I know I was at a meeting with a parole board member who was talking about that they're working with other kind of configurations and try to deal with this population. So it would help me if you would provide us with some information on what's going on in other states, not only with this population, the mental health, the forensics particularly, because I think that's the one that is causing the biggest pressure on your system. And then the other is, how do you get the others into communities, and how do they generate the community support? So that's what I would like to hear from you, and not just from our neighbor to the north, because there's other places in this country that are wrestling with the same issue. And also along with that, would you please check for me and see who's doing mental health courts and how successful they're being in other states, like I believe Indiana is doing the same thing. I think anything that you can bring us from across this country that's working and that have a track record that says that yes, it is making a difference would be very helpful for me.
And there's a difference between statistics, like how many fatalities, and that, if that's the question, you know, on traffic, it's good to see what our surrounding states are. And in an issue like this, what we really would be benefited from is best practices. Where in the United States are they really doing a great job in this, and what are they doing that's different? And so, I mean, you have resources that I'm sure there's associations and those kinds of things, and people that are talking about what they're doing. So that kind of information, even if it was provided for us not in a formal structure, but just electronically or whatever, the more you can, not the quantity, but the better information you can give us, the more impact we can have toward helping to shift things in a way that will not only be more efficient, but more effective. And those are, you know, it's a balance.
Mr. Chairman, we will do that. I wanted to just conclude this by saying that there was a point in the evolution of Fairview, a tipping point, if you will, where the cost per day was exceeding $500 at the institution, and every time a resident left the institution, the cost for the remaining residents increased. And I think we're at that kind of a tipping point in the state hospital for slightly different reasons. One is that the federal government over the last 25 years has really ratcheted up the standards for care. And there are a number of states, and Bob Nickel can research this better than I, are facing federal lawsuits about the standard of care in state hospitals, in spite of the fact that those costs have been so amplified. At the same time, we have to reasonably ask whether the federal government, which is driving the policy that Senator Bates identified, is also funding the alternatives which they're toward which they're pushing the states. One area of real concern is housing, and being able to find sites to develop housing and resources to develop housing is a key to mental health policy in this state. We've had tremendous cooperation and partnership with the Department of Housing and Community Services, which has been has helped us with all of these programs. One of the dark spots in the federal budget is a reduction in community development block grants, which may, I think, really impair the ability of our communities to participate in the financing of housing development. You have to have a place for people to live in addition to providing them with a doctor and a certain pharmacy and a prescription. The next priority, and you probably noticed that we talked about OHP mental health, OHP mental health for kids, intensive services, the state hospital, and now disease prevention and epidemiology. We have a cluster of health programs that are, it's hard to put everything next to each other and say, well, these two things depend on each other, but one has higher priority than the other. Disease prevention and epidemiology is a collection of services, many of which are funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, but also we fund our community local health departments for communicable disease control in this program. So looking at that program as a whole, it's absolutely critical to the health of Oregonians. Disease outbreaks, you heard Dr. Cohn describe that. And then we skip down a number of spots to the 31st priority for the department and the next four health services, which is family health. Just a few minutes ago, you heard a discussion of outcomes under the Oregon Health Plan, which were achieved in partnership with the Office of Family Health in immunization and in prenatal care. So what's the mathematics that tells us where on the relative scale we would put those two programs? Public health systems, which is the next priority after family health, is essentially free of general funded services. What little was remaining was removed in the last round of reductions. But this is an absolutely critical program for licensing everything from water systems to X-ray equipment in dental labs. So the public's health is vitally protected through our Office of Public Health Systems. Radiation, water, food safety, those kinds of activities. The next category are non-OHP payments. The Medicaid program provides assistance with things like Medicare premiums and so forth, cost-sharing requirements for Medicare beneficiaries. It's a complicated area. This is an area that will be affected by the Medicare Modernization Act, as I understand. Is that right, Barney?
Yeah, I'm...
he's reading.
No, I'm... thinking about that.
We'll come back to that.
Okay, Mr. Britton. Mr. Chair, the $152 million of general fund includes about $98 million for the MMA, the Medicare Modernization Clawback.
Correct.
In addition to the payments made for Medicare premiums. So a good chunk of this is the clawback under the Medicare Modernization.
I think another... point to be added to that, Mr. Britton, is that in essence this priority is federally mandated.
Mm-hmm. Alcohol and drug prevention, which we talked about a few moments ago, number 35 for the department. And then here's, when we talk about the state hospital, I think most people think we're talking about the hospital here in Salem. But we also have 60 beds that we operate in Eastern Oregon, in Pendleton, at the Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center. That's the remnant of what was at one time a 1,500-bed institution, which closed in 1983. The governor's recommended budget closes 30 of those beds with the expectation that by, I don't remember the date, but by sometime in the middle of the biennium, we will have replacements for those services in community settings. This priority is at a relatively lower scale because it's the potential for replacement, I think, is better because the patients are not at the same mandated level as they are at Oregon State Hospital. Mm-hmm. That may not be agreed to by everyone who has a concern about the capacity in our state hospitals or who it represents the interests of Eastern Oregonians who believe that that institution is there to serve people from that region. We have next the leveraging components of our Medicaid program in which resources from other jurisdictions, intergovernmental transfers and so forth, pass through the state budget and are matched and then provided to institutions like Oregon Health and Science University, school districts, and other entities, hospitals and so forth. Anything you'd want to add to that one?
No, sir.
The Office of the State Public Health Officer operates our bioterrorism programs, and so it's reasonable to wonder why it's at this level of priority. It's an important office. However, we also have general planning functions and the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, operations which, when compared to the other things that we've been prioritizing, led us to place this in that relative order. There is general fund in this program. It does support some of the functions of local health departments. And so while this is at a relatively lower priority than other programs, from the perspective of local health departments, those components of this budget are critical. Maybe I should say that one of the dilemmas we faced here is that in bringing these priorities forward, because of the way the budget is structured, there are things of relatively higher priority and lower priority in the same budget category. This is a good example of that. The CHIPS program is next.
Yes, sir. In New Hanover. Would you be able to give us a breakdown within that category of the percentage of that budget spent on the items listed? Is that too deep to go? Could you do that?
Chairman, Representative, items listed where?
Here.
In the prose paragraph?
Number 42.
In number 42, your item 42, the public health officer or public health office.
break.
Those items that are listed that are part of the program description.
Yes, we can.
Great.
CHIPS is voluntary. It's an optional program for the state. Voluntary is the wrong word. Optional program for the state, and it is separate from the balance of our Medicaid program. It's an important program for the governor. It's an important program for the state. But for a variety of reasons, it falls into this relative placement.
What percentage of our children are now covered under CHIP, and could you enlighten this committee as to what the match is and how dollars can be leveraged under this particular program?
Mr. Chair, Madam Senator Winters, I believe CHIP is around 22,000 children. They are the children above the current federal mandate for covering children, and the federal match rate is approximately 70-30, 70-72-28, 71-29.
What's the universe if we expanded it?
The universe of mm-hmm. children that would, mm-hmm. if it was expanded upwards into the 200% or 200% plus, there are.
We had it 200%.
I believe we're
185
now. We're at 185 right now, and I believe we have waiver approval to go to 200 with appropriate funding. I will tell you, in working with my colleagues in the health services cluster, and your questions, pointed or otherwise, about where this is on the priority list are appropriate. This is very difficult to lay health programs, both mandatory and optional, that include wide ranges of physical health status, age, opportunity for long life, etc., against public health and mental health programs. They're quite dissimilar in function, but have very impactful outcomes in the community. And that's the only explanation I can give for how this exercise play. This was difficult for the three of us to, and our staffs, to work through this, to say what's more important: getting more kids up the income scale who are not insured, health coverage with a 70-30 match, or having clean water systems.
Exactly.
Can you help me a little bit?
Follow up.
If I can recall, and sometimes it's not accurate, my recollection, because I'm becoming chronologically advantaged, but there was some discussion that where you have children covered, that there is also some tendency that even though the parents aren't covered, that they, in seeing that their children are receiving good health care, that they then in turn also began doing a much better job of taking care of their health, that was one of the outcomes that I don't think was expected. And I think that information was out of one of the New England states, if my memory serves me well, or did I just dream that piece?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I am certain you did not dream it, but I will have to do some research to confirm exactly your statement. But I think there is a dynamic, particularly in uninsured families, that getting access, particularly for the kids, probably heightens the awareness and sensitivity of the adults to really the self-care that they can do, et cetera. I also know the reverse is true, that in some areas, and I think you'll hear this from dental care organizations in the dental community, is that having parents enrolled in dental coverage stimulates their taking children for dental coverage that they may already have.
I think the analogy was that the same as when you're looking at education, where parents are involved, you know, you get the kids and you get the connection, and then you get a much better outcome on both ends.
It's really the family dynamic at work.
Mr. Chairman, I have been wrestling with what Barney... What?
Just to let you know, we've got 20 minutes and we haven't begun.
We're done with priorities just about. I wanted to, if you will indulge me for just a second. Priority setting gives us an opportunity to think about the relative value of things. But in fact, all of us make priorities every day, but rarely do we have to choose between whether we're going to put food on the table or heat the house. We might say, well, we're going to have less steak or less expensive food in preference to something less expensive and turn the thermostat down a degree or two. That's what we haven't been able to capture here because of the way in which this assignment structured the categories which we were prioritizing. And I think Representative Hanna has asked the kind of question to say, well, inside of these structures, what kinds of, and that's what we've been trying to, I think, communicate over the last 4 days, is that there's a lot of complexity here in a $4 billion budget total funds to look at. It's very difficult to communicate a sense of just priorities in this very, very high level view. But I think I hope from this discussion you've gotten some sense of the earnest effort that we put into trying to make those decisions. And I don't envy the committee's job of having to actually put that into the budget process.
My lack of attack indicates that I do realize that.
Yeah.
As I look at these, I can see that these would be very difficult decisions to make. I think I also agree with Representative Hanna that the real question is going to be the components of some of them, because the entire program may be very important, but there may be less important aspects of it that are costly but could be peeled out without affecting the benefit of the entire program. And we don't have to go there yet, but we will before this process. Okay, can we go to 10%
reduction? Please. There are 44 reduction options listed from the department, totaling about $240 million.
Is the first one on the list the first one that if you had to make a cut that you would make, or is the last one on the list that?
I don't think that was, Mr. Chairman, I don't think that was the calculus that we were applying here. We were obliged to bring forward 10% reductions in each of the funding categories.
In the choice,
and it's a list. It is not a plan for a reduction.
It's a list and not a plan. Did you do it? Did you make these the listing alphabetical, numerical?
There's a priority list, Mr. Chairman, in for the department, but it is not a proposal for reductions. Those reductions were proposed, and the governor made those decisions, and actually, the governor's recommended budget is what reflects, I think, the reduction options that the department would propose.
Yes, which is a separate issue than this temporary list here.
I understand that.
And so you're saying there's no prioritization at all in the way that these are listed?
No, they're listed in the sequence that we think that they belong, but I would want to make a couple of observations after saying that we support the governor's choices, which I think goes probably without saying. Most of the items on this list are challenging, much more challenging to achieve than the things that the governor has elected to incorporate in his budget.
And no one is interested in implementing any of these.
Exactly.
But nevertheless, we needed to know that from your experience that if it had to happen, that there is a benefit in the way that you have these listed. That we're going to talk about the first one first, and I just wanted to see that there is a significance to why you put this first.
Well, I don't know which piece of paper to work from at this point, Mr. Chairman. What we've done, you have in your document the entire list for the department. And what we've provided to you this morning is that list for health services and broken down by section. So, for example,
are you talking about the 10%?
I'm talking about the 10% list.
Okay.
So this, do you have this large?
Yep, that's the one we're looking.
The first section lists three reduction options for public health. One option, as you can see, these aren't listed in priority order. If you want to go back to the sequence in priority order, then I have to go to the other piece of paper, and I think that's somewhere in your binder.
This is not the same thing. The priority list and the 10% reduction list are not directly related, because the priority list, is a whole package, and now we're talking about 10% reductions.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I was using the term that you used. Are these reductions in a priority order?
And they are.
And they are. But we haven't displayed them on this piece of paper that way. We displayed them by program area, public health, mental health, and OMAP. But you will see in the left-hand column is the priority number. So I don't. We were prepared to present them according to the program area, but we can do it any way you prefer.
Perhaps it's better to use the term ranking.
Ranked is fine. Okay, they are ranked.
They are ranked.
How would you like to proceed since we have a limited amount of time?
I'd like to use the large piece of paper.
Okay, so you want to start with number one and go through and see what the time we have, or do you want to focus on...
We'll go through all of them. I think we have enough time. The first option in public health is to reduce the number of disorders for which we are testing newborns. Keep in mind, I think, for members of the committee, I need to understand that we were asked to do this exercise for all funds, not just general funds. In this particular case, this is a fee-supported program. You would in effect, be reducing the fee and reducing the number of tests on newborns. The second is to delay the remaining inflation in the essential budget level. As you know, the adjustments...
I just need to remind you, we're using current service level here.
We are.
That's the national standard, and that's what I want to be using here. Thank you.
Be happy to. The current service level included adjustments for inflation. In the governor's recommended budget, those are delayed. This delays them to July of 06. It's an additional period of time. And in public health, that's the impact of that action. It's number 38 in the ranking. Number 41 is reducing the Family Planning Expansion Program. This is a federal waiver that permits us to deliver family planning services exclusively to low-income women, and not just women, but mostly women. This reduction would remove about two-thirds of the clients, about 65,000 individuals. Just one point about family planning is that the match rate is 90%. So every dollar in general fund matches $9 in federal funds. And the research tells us that every dollar of family planning expenditure saves in delivery and pediatric care costs about $5,600. The Office of Mental Health and... Yes, sir.
Excuse me. I just wanted to ask a few questions. This is sort of an academic exercise, and I'm kind of interested in how you went about doing it. And public health happens to be a small enough one we can kind of get a handle for what you're going to talk to us about here in a minute. So I have a question for LFO first, just so I'm matching my numbers up right. We're asking for 10% reductions, correct? According to what I have here, public health is has a $16 million general fund budget. Is that...
Mr. Chair and Senator Bates, they have about a $15 or $16 million special payments budget. There are a number of staff that are actually in the program support and central admin piece of the budget as well within health services. I'm not certain that each particular area had to come up with 10% cuts. My impression was, and I could be wrong, that this was a 10% for the whole health services cluster. So they may have taken less or more in any given area within the health services cluster.
So when I look at the LFO analysis and see $16 million in general fund for this department, and I see a larger than that coming out, it may mean that we're looking at that's part of the overall picture.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bates, yes, but again, within public health, the $15 to $16 million are special payments only because they are separated in terms of the budget structures. But there are lots of staff associated with public health that are in program support, which is a separate budget structure.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, I'm reminded that the reductions are across the entire department, not just across the cluster. So each cluster was not...
Okay.
Right. So move on, or...
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead. Follow-up, please.
You have four or five different things listed by LFO analysis of what this does, this public health does. And most of it seems to have come out of one department, not others. What was sort of the thinking about that? Do you have any idea? I mean, you may not know exactly what went on in public health. And I don't want to zero in on them apps if the first went up. I'm just curious about how some of this occurred, okay? I mean, most of it comes out of family planning, okay? Why family planning versus the other functions of public health? Was it cost basis? Was it you felt that was low on priority for the department?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, there are two reasons. One is the Willie Sutton law, that's where the money is. And the second is that when we began to examine where general fund, and remember this exercise is for each category of funds, where the general fund is invested in the department, we have a couple of $1 million, for example, in the public health laboratory that tests samples. We don't support the newborn screening program with general funds because that's fee related, but there are some things we need, a couple hundred thousand samples a year that we test with our own staff that's supported by general fund. We felt that that was not an option for reduction. And similarly, Oregon pays our local health departments about 60 cents per capita per year for communicable disease and local health department operations, compared, for example, to Washington State at about $4 per capita per year. We're already at such a low threshold, we didn't feel that we could proceed further. So the way this has worked in the past, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, is that we've had lists.
I'm not going to talk about this later. We're taking up committee time.
Okay.
I'll get to you later.
We do have a question that, just to try and coordinate these things, we're looking at the first column and line on the 10% reduction, and it says it's priority department 33. In the far left column, and it's reduced number of disorders for which newborns, and then we go to priority 33 on the priority list, and it's dealing with OMAP, and it's $252 million, and the 10% reduction here is $1 million, and so we're having a hard time coordinating.
Mr. Chairman, that's why I suggested using the term ranking.
Okay.
The priority, the department priority that's listed, that's noted on this document, doesn't cross foot to the priority of the programs in DHS or the health services cluster. It refers to the ranking of the 10% cuts across the whole department. We should, and we will change the nomenclature on this, but if you think of this as the rank of the cuts,
the ranking of the cuts. The 10% reduction list that we're working on today is on health services only. The number on here, which is number 33, refers to the overall agency 10% list, not the prioritized list, separate list. It ought to be number 33 on the cut list.
It is. There's a
we're looking at the wrong list.
Yeah.
If you go to the department-wide section, list the cuts, it looks like this, and it's number 33 on that list, not the priority list. The first mental health reduction is to close one adolescent ward, and as I mentioned earlier, that decision has already been made by the governor, and we are proceeding to implement it. It will eliminate the last remaining ward of adolescents at Oregon State Hospital and relocate those services to community care. The next is the...
Can I interrupt just a moment? I'd like to just change the procedure a little bit because we have such a short amount of time. If the committee could look through the list, and if you have specific questions, because we're not going to make it through the list, and that way we can focus on those things that are of greatest import, because we're not going to make it. Okay, so let's just pause for a moment and see if we have some questions for you. We appreciate this information, and we can go through it and call you individually if we need to, but for the next 5 minutes, let's just see if we can focus on issues that are specific.
So where's the department-wide list?
It should be earlier.
It should be that big one.
It should be right next to where you have your thick prioritization list.
This one?
Yeah.
Total VHS.
Which
one?
It's the overall agency cut list.
So go to
your list is way down.
Should be.
That's number 30.
Right. I really appreciate that.
That's my kind of hard to do, wouldn't it? Yeah, but they've been very cooperative. Judgment in hand, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
That community is very cooperative with the state.
In working if we need to.
Right.
Mr. Chairman?
Certainly.
Would you like me to play the role of Willie Sutton and go to OMAP, since you noted out of, since if you look at the page 3 of 3, that from a general fund point of view, this reduction list totals $131 million, and $110 million is out of OMAP, so we're the bank. And I'll just give you an overview of the approaches that we used for these items. One is a continuing a reduction from the 2003-2005 biennium in the amount of payment to DRG hospitals. We worked down because, again, it was noted that we had to have 10% cut across all fund sources. So the number, the second one in the OMAP list is the leverage reduction, which has impacts on programs outside of OMAP, but it's there because of the other fund reduction. And not to go into, I will answer questions, but the remaining ones are, in fact, the classic ones that we have dealt with you and with the advocates community over the last two bienniums, a combination of reducing populations that are optional, like the PLM children, you noted the and other populations that are OHP eligible because of the Staley agreement or changing the SPD client levels. We have the CHIP program on here for the comments that were already made, and then the 47 and the lowest priority cut would be a 60% reduction in a prescription benefit, again, because as looking at not only optional populations but optional services of how to get to the 10%. Some of this is how do we get to the number large enough to meet the target that you want, that was asked for in this exercise.
I want you to know that I appreciate this, because this is a rational approach. You know, that you don't say we're going to cancel the plan for 2 months, you know, but we control the levels, which affects the income or the expenditure.
That's a broad overview of the ranking on the of OMAP's share of the health services cluster, illustrated on page 2 and 3.
Okay. Thoughts, comments, questions on any of them? Senator Westland.
Well, just and I suppose this is a question and a comment rolled into one, but is it fair for purposes of our review with this in quieter moments when we have time to actually study it? Is it fair that we look at this from the perspective of the health services cluster within the overall budget, that what you were trying to do here is rank and reduce, trying to take into consideration the overall condition of wellness that we can continue to provide, as opposed to specific delivery services? You were trying to look at a bigger picture, services relative to other services, and what that means to us as a state, as opposed to individual silo delivery systems to a given population or stakeholder group. Is that a fair characterization?
Mr. Chairman, we should look at this? Senator Weston, that's exactly the question that needs to be asked, because of the 44 options that are ranked by the department, only 4 of health services reduction options are in the top 20. And what that really reflects is the interdependence of programs, so that if you take a look at the outcomes that we're trying to achieve in child welfare or in self-sufficiency or in seniors and people with disabilities, they depend on an effective health care delivery system. And that's why I think that the relative ranking reflects that sense of the importance of health and health care and of all of the other
conditions, wellness or health status. And that's
indeed
how I look at these, and I appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you. Any final remarks before we close? Mr. Spate?
Mr. Chairman, we've appreciated the two days here presenting the OMAP portion and then the health services cluster priorities, and we look forward to phase two and other questions that will arise during your deliberations. Thank you very much.
It's been very
thank you, and I want to appreciate the bank that we have here in Mr. Spate's program.
We've all benefited from all of your experience. Thank you. We're now adjourned.